Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. On today's program, our guest is Chris Carey, founder and president of Chris Carey Advisors, LLC, which works with companies to increase profits and improve performance. Chris Carey Advisors offers business advisory services, banking and financing consulting, mergers and acquisitions advisory, and turnaround expertise. Chris leverages existing resources and applies proprietary measurement and reporting systems to increase revenues, profits, and cash flow. He has developed and employs a five-step methodology that assists small and mid-sized companies to boost profits during this recession. Chris has a 30-year track record as an entrepreneur and CEO, building and leading startups and establishing companies. He also works with distressed companies to implement turnarounds. Chris, welcome to Edgewise.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, let's go right to the heart of the matter. What is the relationship between company culture and profit?
It's probably one of the most untapped sources of improved profitability in companies. Most CEOs and leaders don't pay enough attention to managing and defining and improving the culture. There's extremes. Obviously, there's Zappos, where it's wild and crazy, and they've leveraged that to profitability. Then the other extreme is where a culture is extremely dysfunctional. People are arguing at odds with one another, a great deal of negativity, and you can appreciate the difference in those two extremes and how a dysfunctional culture would really, really lag in profitability.
Are there cultures in departments as well as in full companies?
There are very different cultures within departments of a company, but it happens the most when there's a geographical regional office. In those situations where there may be a certain culture managed by the executives of the business near headquarters, in outlying offices, what you'll often find is rogue cultures where people are operating very differently than the way prescribed back at headquarters. So distance and regional locations often create the greatest disparities.
Also, I think responsibilities within the departments might prompt different cultures.
There are different kinds of cultures based on functional groups. There'll be a very different culture that you'll find in the IT department or the programming group. It's more like a Microsoft geeky culture than you'd find in the sales department or customer service, where they have regular day-to-day interaction with customers and they can have some opportunity to get feedback on product or services. In many cases, it's a little bit easier actually to manage a positive culture in those kinds of environments. Then you have the people who may be in jobs or functions that aren't as interesting or as pleasant to deal with. People who are working in a factory that may not be in the best condition, it would be more difficult to manage to a very positive culture there.
But whoever is responsible for the organization or department has to be aware of that culture and want it to be the most productive culture.
A culture typically comes directly from leadership. One of the three big things that a CEO should be doing is defining and managing the culture. But when you have these outlying operations, that local business unit will often take over the culture as defined and led by that manager.
Okay. So within a company, somebody who's a department manager can be running a department with a totally different culture.
Absolutely. I had an interesting experience. I had a business. We were doing IT professional services. We had guys in trucks driving around the country doing installations for Macy's and Pizza Huts and Saks Fifth Avenue. At the time, we had about 10 offices located at either coast, Chicago, Dallas, headquartered in New Jersey. I thought we had a certain culture, and it was the one I was promoting and the one I thought I had control over. But as I traveled around, I was shocked at what some of the cultural elements were in some of these outlying offices. And in many cases, it was not the one I was hoping for. It really required a lot of attention to defining what it really was and managing that culture and getting it instilled in all of the people. And that's a challenge for most leaders.
Well, it doesn't just happen.
Well, you get a culture. It does happen. As soon as you get three or more people in a company, you automatically get a culture. The question is, what is it? And is it positive and healthy and conducive to business growth and profitability? What often happens is you get culture by default.
And what we're looking for is the kind of culture in your industry that causes profitability?
I don't find that as important as matching the culture to the leader and to the goals of that business. A huge determinant of cultural style is the leadership and management style that is adopted by that company. The right culture, which is sustainable, has got to be a culture that the leader can manage to. Leadership styles are a continuum. They start out being very directive, dictatorial, benevolent dictator, and go all the way to non-directive, consensus style, and laissez-faire. So you can't have a Bozo the Clown culture being managed by an ex-army general. You really have to have a culture that's consistent with the leadership and the leader's personality type. The most important thing here is for the leader to at least be conscious of it, that it exists, that it can be changed.
But how can they do that?
The style has to be consistent with how that leader is most comfortable. But once you determine that, you can make modifications. You can go from a middle style of, say, consultative, where you're getting the opinion of your associates, but they may not have a vote, to maybe a more participatory style where they do get to vote, but it's just not equal. So there are ways of taking subtle steps that have a huge impact on the way it's received by the workers and how those workers react to it in a positive way, becoming more participatory in the business and having a greater stake in its success. And then you need to understand what are the ramifications for that and have consistency in the way that everybody leads and manages and consistency in the way that you communicate. For example, if you're going to drive to a participatory or a consensus style where people's votes do count and maybe are even equal to the manager, you can't have a dictatorial style of coming down on people if they make a mistake.
Right. That's an interesting point. So how do you go about transforming cultures? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I've had a number of really exciting experiences in modifying a business culture, and it is not easy. What happens is most workers have gotten used to the leader going away to some seminar, coming back all charged up. Now we're going to have a new culture. And they pretty much have found in the past that if they just waited out a month or two, it'll go away.
Right.
So changing is hard. It's not impossible. And you can definitely change a culture to be much, much more positive, where you can tap into the strengths and enthusiasm of the people that work with you. There's huge benefits if you do it properly.
So what can leaders do?
The first thing you need to do is understand what is the culture, not just where you work, but in all these outlying areas. And that takes some time. You can institutionalize some of this in a morale and leadership survey to determine, are people in the business consistent with the leadership styles and mission values statements that you've made? You can do this on a twice a year basis, and it gives you the ability to initially get feedback. And it can be then an ongoing method of getting regular feedback from associates as to whether the company is achieving those goals in terms of culture or not. Simple questions like, does your manager live up to the company's three core values? And when you get a no answer back, that really is a red flag that you've got an issue with that individual. I haven't found the need to change the leader, but I have found the need to change some of the managers. Typically, once the leader has communicated, this is the style we're going to manage, and this is the kind of culture we're going to work towards, there's resistance and undermining by the middle managers. And those are people you need to really understand, try to coach, mentor, train, and occasionally terminate.
You know, it seems when people talk about changing the culture, they mean making the workplace more fun. Is that the only way to change the culture?
In my opinion, most of the U.S. workforce has been abused. I've had a similar experience in Canada and Europe. They haven't been listened to. They haven't been tapped into as a resource. They've been ignored. They've been insulted and pretty much abused in terms of what they really crave in a work situation. And that's to make a difference, to be recognized, and lastly, to be compensated properly. If you can tap into this frustrated worker, this worker who has not been appreciated, who hasn't had an opportunity to express themselves in their workplace, you get enormous benefits. People who walk around with a scowl and watch the clock become these incredibly committed workers who work all hours and go to great extremes to satisfy customers. Just give them a chance, set the boundaries, give them the support they need in the training, and get out of the way. I'm not a proponent of a laissez-faire style. People want a leader and a manager involved. A consensus style is incredibly effective, very difficult to get to. It requires a lot of trust on the part of the manager and the worker. In your culture, if you realize that you're maybe a little dictatorial and maybe occasionally consultative, get people more involved, have regular meetings, get them informed, get them into the process. And you'll find that as you educate them, as you release their potential and empower them, they'll start deserving to participate at a higher level, at some point get to a consensus style. there are lots of types of cultures that work, and there are extremes. There's the happy, fun culture, and then there's the dictatorial my way or the highway culture. But there are certain situations like the military, a culture that needs more of a dictatorial style, but it works. Now, the military has gotten way more open and solicits opinions and feedback more than it used to, but there's extremes like that that do work. Now, there are other extremes at the other end of the happy scale that work also. But most of those end up with a clear set of goals, a clear understanding of what the limits are to the job and what the range is of decision-making.
Exactly. I think you're absolutely right. So can you give us an example of that?
Absolutely. At a Ritz-Carlton down in Atlanta, they gave tremendous amount of authority all the way to the housekeepers and the bellmen, and they could spend up to hundreds of dollars at an incident to satisfy a customer. They set the rules, they gave them education and training, and they let them free. But what I think doesn't work is the be happy, be fun without any rules and without any goals and without an understanding of what the company's trying to accomplish.
So what should organizations do?
A really big part of leveraging a workforce is information. I work a lot with closely held companies. These are, in many cases, family-owned, where the information on the financial performance isn't readily available. It's not like a public company where you just wait for the quarterly statements to come out. There's a tremendous resistance to sharing any information whatsoever. And these owners, leaders, they've got this fear. My God, I show them the numbers, they're going to be running to me for a raise. And every single instance I find, people think that a little bit less than your revenue is your net profit. And then if you take the bold step of showing them gross profit, so they at least know their direct cost of goods sold, the materials and the labor that they're putting in at the assembly line or the service they're providing, and whether they're making a good gross profit or not, most times the workers will think that gross profit is pretty much the net profit number. In all these instances, people are very resistant to information, but if they release the information, and I'm not saying give everything to everybody, but to the levels in the organization where they need the information to make the right kind of decisions, time after time, I see people take the information responsibly, deal with it in a trustworthy way, and use it to make decisions to improve profit in the company.
Right. Now, you might have a leader who believes in opening the door to this information and an open management approach. So, as a leader, one of the things you might want to do is undertake training to teach managers, don't you think?
Absolutely. It's so interesting. The leaders of a company typically assume that everybody, even middle management level, understands what a P&L statement is and what a balance sheet and a cash flow are. So there's a need to educate and train. There's some really terrific examples like Whole Foods, where they created these self-managed teams within the departments. And those team members get access to all the financials of the department, of the store, of the chain, and review it on a weekly basis and can really participate. They feel like they're part of the process. Just very, very positive.
Exactly. It's a difference between delegation and empowerment.
Yeah.
Okay, now, can you talk to us a little bit about the best ways for us to improve the quality of our people and their performance?
So much of it is just getting out there and talking to people. I recently worked on this project. It had been a family-owned business, family-owned and run for about 17 years, an unbelievably positive culture. These workers would do anything for the family. The way the family got that was being extremely involved with the associates on the warehouse floor. During peak periods, they'd go out, lend a hand, they'd jump into the line. If they were working overnight, they'd jump into the deal with them. They cared for them. They held celebration lunches, all these really positive things. The business was sold 2 years ago to a venture fund, and the venture fund brought in the big bureaucrat from one of the big competitors, was the multi-billion dollar company CEO coming in to manage the $100 million business. And the fellow wouldn't go out onto the floor. He'd take a walk around, but he wouldn't go out and be part of the group. He avoided contact with
the common folk?
Yes, exactly. And where we were all doing pizza lunches once a month to review results and have customers come in. And there was a lot of caring and sharing and recognition and employee of the month and special parking spots. This fellow's style was all about the numbers. And you could see over a relatively quick period of time, the culture deteriorating. It didn't have to be a family member. If you had just reached out, if you had just become part of that mix.
Right. And you also speak as somebody who founded your own company.
Yeah. I started a company in 1976, grew to 750 people, $100 million, operations throughout US and Canada. I had my comeuppance in the late 80s. We had huge defect rates. We had incredible revisit rates. Customer satisfaction was at the very low 70 percentile. I actually brought in the Tom Peters Group at the time to coach me. It was very funny because where most companies would say, okay, we're going to improve the culture and we're going to improve the company, and they take the top tier of managers away for some golf outing, stay in some really nice hotel. What we did is allowed the group to self-select 40 representatives from the company in every job function. So we brought people from the assembly facility, people from the field, people from the accounting department, and we all went to a YMCA camp up in New York State called Frost Valley, where for $1.50 a day, you got room and board. It was unbelievable. Out of that came a resolution of how we were going to improve. And this group of 40 became the emissaries to go out into, at the time, 15 offices around the US and Canada to spread the word. And we created this incredible culture of recognition. We held quarterly events. And after a year, we saw a huge improvement in customer satisfaction. Within 2 or 3 years, 98% of our customers were 100% satisfied. Our revisit and rework rates were incredibly low. Just a huge improvement in profitability.
Well, it demonstrates the culture can make a major difference in the bottom line of a business.
Absolutely.
Now, just to wrap this up, is there anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with?
One of the things that is really, really important in trying to modify a culture is to involve your customers. To do it in a vacuum is not very effective. We worked with a company out in New Jersey. They're in the guard services business. That whole industry has been pretty much commoditized, and every one of those companies is caught in a death spiral of pressure on fees from the customer, which lowers rates to the guards, which lowers service, which puts more pressure from the customer on rates. The company had experienced incredible losses, drop in revenue, loss of customers. Their turnover rate was 140%. Customer satisfaction was in the 60 percentile. So we did something very different there. We created a cultural program called WOW, which is WOW the Customer. We partnered with customers and piloted it with a customer where we involved the customer's management team and the guard team, all the guards and the supervisor on site. We held sessions where we got feedback from both sides of how each could improve. We thought it would be the guards sitting around listening, and it actually was a two-way street where the guards said, by the way, you got to give us a place to go to the bathroom and you got to fix the fence, things like that. What was really amazing was the customer said, if you can get the level of satisfaction from 60 to 90, we'll give you $1.50 more per hour. And once the guards knew there was a payback, they formed up a Whole Foods-type team. They engaged with the customer on a weekly basis. They self-managed. They self-selected. They disciplined people who didn't show up on time and terminated them when necessary. And within a very short period of time, the customer satisfaction went up. They got the $1.50. And this team provided an enormous improvement in customer service. That was then implemented throughout the entire company, to where now customer satisfaction is at 92%. Turnover has gone from 140 down to 67. Companies return to profitability. So you can do it fast. It takes bold action on the part of the leader of the company, but it's very, very possible and yields a huge benefit and profit.
We've been speaking to Chris Carey, founder and president of Chris Carey Advisors, LLC. Chris, thanks so much.
Well, thanks, Dave. It's been a real pleasure.
With only an internet connection and a browser, you can tap into AMA's world-class training. The American Management Association is bringing live instructor-led training right to your desktop. AMA's new virtual seminar offering features a live virtual format that is highly interactive and very user-friendly. It's taught by the same expert, world-class faculty that run our classroom sessions, and the high-quality content has been specially engineered to run in an online format. You get real-time online interaction with your course leader and your fellow attendees. You will receive a USB headset so that you can not only listen but talk to your classmates and your instructor. So take advantage of these offerings, enhance your career journey by building your skills, and you don't have to take any time away from the office. For more information about AMA's virtual seminar offering, visit our website at www.amanet.org. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.